because we got the alternative energy. Right. Nuclear free autonomy.
And welcome to the Radioactive Show, produced at the studios of 3CR Melbourne and heard nationally on the Community Radio Network.
Hello and welcome to the Radioactive Show. On January 27th, the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists announced that the Doomsday Clock, universally recognized as an indicator of the world's vulnerability to global catastrophe caused by man-made technologies, was the closest it has ever been to midnight, 85 seconds, a significant shift from last year's 89 seconds. In their announcement, they said, "A year ago, we warned that the world was perilously close to global disaster and that any delay in reversing course increased the probability of catastrophe. Rather than heed this warning, Russia, China, the United States, and other major countries have instead become increasingly aggressive, adversarial, and nationalistic. Hard-won global understandings are collapsing, accelerating a winner-takes-all great power competition and undermining the international cooperation critical to reducing the risks of nuclear war, climate change, the misuse of biotechnology, the potential threat of artificial intelligence, and other apocalyptic dangers. Far too many leaders have grown complacent and indifferent, in many cases adopting rhetoric and policies that accelerate rather than mitigate these existential risks. Because of this failure of leadership, the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists and Security Board today sets the doomsday clock at 85 seconds to midnight, the closest it has ever been to catastrophe." I'm Michaela, and today on the show, I'm going to discuss the collapse of one of these global understandings, the New START Treaty, with our special guest, Dr. Tilman Ruff. Tilman Ruff is a public health and infectious disease physician, a board member and past co-president of the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, and a co-founder and founding international and Australian chair of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. He's a member of the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons Scientific Network.
Thank you so much, Tilman, for joining us on the Radioactive Show. The new Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, which was the last arms control agreement between the United States and Russia, expired on Friday, the 6th of February, thus removing the last legally binding limits on the world's two largest nuclear arsenals at a time of rising global tension and increasing nuclear threats. Before we go into what this means for the world, I was wondering if you could just explain to us a bit about the formation of the treaty and what it's achieved over its life.
So yes, it's the last treaty that constrains Russian and US nuclear weapons numbers. There was a history of those that started really in the 70s that progressively somewhat reduced and sort of constrained the numbers, particularly of long-range weapons. So not all their nuclear weapons, mainly the so-called strategic ones, so the big ones. Essentially, strategic means they can go more than 5,500 kilometres. So generally, these are the big transcontinental ones that can go pretty much anywhere in the world in about half an hour or less. So the numbers of those have progressively reduced. In their peak of nuclear weapons in the world was in 1986, when there were over 70,000, and there are now 12,300 roughly, unfortunately going up again. But a significant part of that reduction has happened through these bilateral agreements that have progressively gradually reduced the numbers of weapons and capped the types, and had inspection and verification systems so that both sides could be sure that the other was doing what they'd promised. So they've been a really important part of sort of nuclear control. They're not with the explicit object of going for disarmament. I mean, they don't lead in any automatic way. They only involve, thus far, have only involved the Soviet Union, then Russia, and the United States, the two largest nuclear armed states. But between them, they have now close to 90%. So 87% of the world's nuclear weapons are in Russian and American hands. And in the past, it was even higher, over 90%. So it is important. The treaty was signed by President Obama and President Medvedev of Russia in 2010, and it was envisaged that it would be in place for a 10-year time frame, presumably during which they would negotiate something else. There was potential for it to be extended, but only once, by 5 years, and that's already happened. And what it did is reduce overall the number of strategic warheads, so on intercontinental ballistic missiles, on missiles in holes in the ground, bombs delivered by heavy long-range bombers, and warheads on long-range missiles on submarines to 1,550 on each side. The previous treaty that succeeded it, the SALT Treaty, took them down to between 1,700 and 2,200. Previous treaties, the first START treaty was even bigger numbers, so gradually coming down. So 1,550 warheads on 700 of the specified long-range launchers, missiles, bombers, submarines, and usefully only an additional 100 launchers could be possessed by either side, so they couldn't have the capacity to accumulate a large number of launch platforms in reserve, break out of the treaty, and then, have substantially larger numbers of weapons to deploy. So it was useful, and it was accompanied by a pretty stringent and comprehensive regime of verification. And that involved regular, twice a year, they would notify each other of exactly what they were doing with their long-range weapons, what their plans were. They would notify each other on a pretty much ongoing and daily basis for any movement or developments or use of those warheads and launchers in exercises or moving them around. So really helpful reassurance. Almost on a daily basis, the military commanders were in touch with each other so that they didn't have to worry that this series of missiles being put on trucks here or being moved from here to there, might signal something they needed to worry about. And there was also capacity for on-site inspections of both sides of those warheads and launchers at quite short notice. So physically go and have a look. They ended up being suspended during COVID, but until then they worked well. And there was also a bilateral commission established that had clear processes for how they would address and resolve any disputes between them. So essentially, it was implemented like all of the other treaties that they introduced to limit and constrain nuclear weapons. It worked. They were implemented on time and in a verified way, and providing very valuable sort of risk reduction and confidence building and communication between the two sides. So all of that unfortunately goes by the wayside now with the end of that treaty. So when the treaty first exp was due for expiry at the 10-year mark, President Putin offered to re-extend it, but Trump, in his first incarnation, didn't reciprocate. So Biden, within a couple of days of coming to office and just days before the treaty would have otherwise expired, agreed to extend it for another 5 years. On this occasion, when the treaty's coming up for to its end, and clearly everybody knows when that's going to happen, there's plenty of opportunity for negotiations to start on something to replace it. But that didn't happen, partly poisoned by the conflict over Russia's invasion of Ukraine, but also a lot of bluff and bluster and brinkmanship and unilateral action on both sides, a really erosion of cooperation and respect for agreements and international law, and massive building up of the military forces, which is well underway. So it's a really toxic general environment. But Putin, in September last year, offered to respect the numeric limits of the treaty for another year if the US reciprocated. Donald Trump has flip-flopped on this, as he has on many things. Mid last year, he was saying, "Sounds like a when Putin made that offer, he said, "Sounds like a good idea." Earlier, he had reinforced a couple of times the importance of having numeric limits on Russian American nuclear weapons, he thought was a good thing, good for the security of both of them and indeed the world. But more recently, he certainly hasn't formally responded to the Russian offer. And most recently, when he was extensively interviewed by the New York Times, he basically said, well, if it expires, it expires. We'll negotiate something better. Really dismissive of its value and not clearly not reciprocating in terms of extending its limits, respect for its limits. He's also put a condition on that any new agreement should involve China. He obviously sees China as a major threat, and China's nuclear arsenal is certainly growing, but still, less than 11% of the size of the American arsenal, and less than a similar amount of the Russian arsenal. So the Chinese arsenal is still, roughly a tenth of the size of either of those others. And China has never been involved in negotiations with either of them on nuclear arms control before. And they say adamantly and consistently that, until your arsenals come down a long way and are much closer in size to ours, we're not talking. So such a trilateral negotiation would be more complicated and time consuming anyway. These things take years to negotiate normally. It's not something you pop out next week. So that seems to be perhaps a recipe for failure and looking for somebody else to blame for the failure of negotiations rather than a serious attempt. And if they want to negotiate with China, fine, but that's no reason not to, to abandon the last agreement with the Russians. So that's where we are now, a much more dangerous world where, by best estimates from the Federation of American Scientists, that both sides, because they've got so many warheads in reserve, like their numbers capped by that treaty, and there's some pretty weird counting in there too, where like long-range bombers that can carry multiple warheads are counted as one. So some of the counting is a bit bizarre, but even allowing for that, because they've got so many weapons in reserve, both of them. Some of them weapons that were slated for dismantlement but haven't yet been, and some of them that have just they're just not in active service at present. They could deploy probably about double the number of strategic nuclear weapons within a matter of months without those treaty constraints. And there'll be a lot more uncertainty, a lot more pressure to think worst case scenarios, hedge for the build up. It'll help drive an arms race that's already underway, but also the loss of that communication and inspection verification regime, that's now basically entirely gone.
Yeah, I remember when I was growing up, there'd been this cartoon that was around our house that had Reagan and Gorbachev sort of sitting up on the clouds with a fried nuclear destroyed Earth fizzing below, and them sitting up there with their weapons and saying to each other, "Oh, your paranoia was worse than my paranoia." I guess that's, that not knowing what each other exactly had or were doing with their weapons did really drive that arms race.
There's certainly
Made me
been
think
plenty of
of.
instances where, exercises, for example, the Able Archer exercise in Europe, a big NATO exercise in 1983, was at a time of great tension, was interpreted by the Russians as the prelude for a launch, and it almost led to nuclear war on the Russian side because they misinterpreted. They thought it was the start of war rather than a military exercise. And yeah, there's the potential for worst case thinking and for rash reaction and the pressure to use weapons, to use them or lose them, so to speak, to because of the short flight of missiles. Even land-based missiles take less than half an hour to land, and submarine-launched missiles, from off your coast, will take less than 10 minutes to land somewhere. So by the time you've detected the launches, the time for decision and response is really short. So the pressure to react, it can be again really complicate what's already a very dangerous sort of hair trigger situation of weapons, thousands of weapons, many of them these long range, very destructive weapons on high alert, ready to be launched within a minute, within minutes of a decision to do so. They're also the ones that are most vulnerable to accidental launch or to cyber attack.
Thinking about that, you know, the ramifications from anybody starting a nuclear war just seem to undermine, like, even their use. Like, they're not, don't seem like a very usable weapon, and extraordinary amounts of money go into their upkeep. And I'm wondering, why are these nuclear armed states so tied to keeping their nuclear weapons? I mean, we don't want them to use any weapons, but you'd think just from their own strategic point of view that there'd be lots of other things that they could put their money into that would make them
Yeah, and they're clearly
more
not
secure.
Going to be immune from any consequences. Yes,
exactly.
I mean, policies to deploy and use nuclear weapons are really divorced from evidence of what those weapons actually do. And there's been some pretty high-level reports and assessments of this recently. I'm thinking, for example, of a report from the US National Academy of Sciences in just 2023 that basically says US nuclear weapons policy is completely lacking in a good evidence base. It's not cognizant of and built on any kind of comprehensive understanding of the dangers and what the weapons actually do. In terms of burns, fires, radiation, disruptions to societies, climate, food production, all that the military thinks about is blast. Because, you know, to destroy a specified military target, particularly one that's buried or hardened, you need blast is the key variable, and that's easy to measure and well understood for weapons. So the military planning is largely all around blast that completely ignores all of the other effects, which have not stood still either. I mean, our understanding of what nuclear weapons do has dramatically increased. And it's really obvious. I mean, even just a cursory examination of the evidence around what nuclear weapons do reveals that they are simply unusable weapons. They must never be used. Even to the idea of mutually assured destruction as the sort of theoretical underpinning of so-called deterrence strategy, this psychological construct and game that, you know, rational actors won't do things that invite unacceptable consequences, i.e. risk nuclear retaliation. That's not the situation. The situation is of self-assured destruction. If nuclear weapons are used, whether you retaliate or not, we now know that even a couple of hundred nuclear weapons, even in one part of the world, targeted on cities, would put so much sooty black smoke blanketing the earth for over a decade, cool, darken and dry the climate, decimate agriculture and put billions of people at risk of starvation worldwide from a nuclear war involving 1 or 2% of the world's nuclear weapons in one part of the world. So the whole sort of fig leaf of deterrence is really a completely, you know, non-credible construct. If deterrence was really the logic behind nuclear weapons and their continued deployment and the policies for their use, then how many would you need? Two? One? Five? Less than 10, I can tell you. When Robert McNamara asked that question as incoming defense secretary in the 1960s, he was told, oh, about 300, so we can hit basically all the Russian and Chinese cities. So why did you get up to 30,000? You know, why do you, the numbers bear no relationship to reality. It's just the relentless logic of power, of assertion of military and political weight. It's all the vested interests that get built up in the bureaucracies, in the military, in the defense contractors, in all the pork barreling around defense, vast defense expenditure. You know, it's this juggernaut that bears no relationship to reality. If you had weapons for deterrence, you would have just a few. You would have them on an invulnerable platform that nobody knew where it was, like a submarine at the moment. Submarines may not be so invisible in the future, but they kind of are now. You would not have them on high alert. You would not deploy them on anybody else's territory. You would not have strategies of nuclear war fighting and winning, of trying to actually target nuclear forces with the idea of prevailing. And you may not tell anybody, but if nuclear weapons were used, you would not use them because deterrence had failed. And what's the point of cementing global suicide? So nuclear weapons are used every day by large and powerful states to assert power, to throw their weight around, to claim impunity for otherwise aggressive and illegal actions, economic, military, political. The Russian invasion of Ukraine, Israel's extremely aggressive actions in the Middle East, the attacks of Israel and the United States on safeguarded Iranian nuclear facilities, a state that doesn't have nuclear weapons. These are all, the playbook of nuclear armed states acting essentially with impunity under cover of the brutality of their nuclear weapons.
You're tuned to The Radioactive Show, produced in the studios of 3CR Community Radio and broadcast across the continent thanks to the Community Radio Network. Today, I'm bringing a conversation with Dr. Tilman Ruff, expert in public health and longtime nuclear-free campaigner. We're talking about the collapse of the New START Treaty, which saw the United States and Russia set limits and reporting mechanisms on their activity in regards to their strategic nuclear warheads. The New START Treaty expired on Friday the 6th of February, and today we're talking about what that means globally and for us here on this continent.
Looking at maybe some of the more immediate implications for us on this continent, the collapse of START could see an increase of those loaded and ready to go nuclear weapons increasing. And with nuclear capable US B-52 bombers planned to be regularly based at Tyndall RAF base in the Northern Territory later this year, would that in turn increase the likelihood that those B-52s could be carrying nuclear weapons, which is something that the Australian government has said they won't pressure the US to confirm or deny?
Yes, this treaty is not just some arcane thing in Washington and Moscow. This affects us very directly. Australia plans to deploy on permanent rotation. So it's a really dishonest, it's a deployment, it's a basing. These are dedicated facilities. They've spent $1.5 billion on a dedicated apron, hangars, fuel and ammunition storage, somewhere between 100 or 150 permanent US staff based at Tyndall to maintain these aircraft that will be there fly in, fly out, but there will be a presence of B-52 bombers the whole time. So that, despite our obligation under the South Pacific Nuclear Free Zone Treaty not to accept the stationing or emplacement of nuclear weapons in Australia. So it's a big step up for Australia. We have already for decades been part of the sort of software end of nuclear weapons, the command and control, targeting, the intelligence that supports their use and deployment and targeting through Pine Gap and Northwest Cape and other facilities. But now we're actually moving towards operational basing in a way that we never have before. So currently, 30 of the roughly 70 fleet of big long-range American B-52 bombers under New START were rendered not capable of carrying nuclear weapons. And Professor Richard Tanter and Dr. Vince Scapaturo at Macquarie have done extraordinary work documenting every single B-52, identifying it, identifying whether it's nuclear capable or not. So until recently, there was an option. Australia could have said, thanks very much, we only want the non-nuclear capable one, B-52s rotating through Tyndall, which was physically feasible to do, given almost half the fleet was non-nuclear capable. But it's quite likely that with the end of New START, the rationale, the requirement to have those 30 planes non-nuclear capable has gone. The legislation to enable them to be reverted back to nuclear capable was actually part of a defense bill that passed under the Biden administration in December 24. So it's kind of already enabled. All that needs to, the Secretary of the US Air Force is authorized to revert those planes to nuclear capable, given if advice if ordered to do so, and the instruction would come from the administration. They don't have to go to Congress again. It would only cost about $4.5 million US dollars estimated, so peanuts in terms of defense spending, and it could happen quite quickly. So I think we haven't heard whether that is de will definitely happen, but I think there's a high likelihood, given the way that the Trump administration's talking in a very bellicose, aggressive way, building up nuclear forces, accelerating the nuclear modernizations that are already well underway, that were part of the very high political price that President Obama paid for getting New START through a Republican-controlled Senate in 2010. So there's this massive program of US modernization, really refurbishing all of the facilities that produce nuclear weapons and the nuclear weapons themselves. And part of that is also the development of a new sea-launched cruise missile. So I'll come, perhaps I'll just finish the B-52. So we could have said, Australia, we only want non-nuclear capable B-52s here, thanks very much. But we haven't said that. And we know that it's possible to do that because during the whole period of the 1980s, Malcolm Fraser, as Prime Minister, was the only national leader who has actually not accepted that neither confirm nor deny policy that the US usually requires of its allies, and said, you will not bring armed B-52s or any other nuclear armed aircraft into Australia, and you will tell us, and we will know, and that information must be public. It was an extraordinary initiative, very commendable, that he took in the 1980s, and it worked. They did it. But the government has put no such conditions on the B-52s, and now they will probably even lose the opportunity to put any conditions on them. So if you're going to have B-52s here, then they'll all be potentially nuclear capable. They wouldn't normally carry nuclear weapons in peacetime, but they could. And if push comes to shove, they could potentially bring nuclear weapons into Australia and even launch them from Australia, even without our knowledge or consent. There's currently no firm barrier on nuclear weapons being brought into or launched from Australia. So that's a really significant step up, and that makes us a much higher priority target, even for China and Russia and any adversaries of the United States or anybody else that we get caught up in conflicts with, but obviously the United States most likely. And the Chinese officials have said so. And a parallel thing is happening with the attack submarines, the US Virginia class attack submarines, that it's planned to also have on permanent rotation, effectively basing. I mean, they're still spending $12 billion, expanding and modernizing the port and Garden Island and Fremantle. There's a conflict, because there's huge amounts of housing that they want to dedicate to US personnel to service those submarines, a huge Australian investment to support what will essentially become a submarine base, even if we don't get any AUKUS submarines of our own. But those US attack submarines, nuclear powered, but they have not had nuclear weapons on them, either those or on any of the surface ships of the US Navy since 1991, when President Bush the Elder removed them. But there is now a plan for a new sea-launched cruise missile, that was started during the first Trump administration, suspended during the Biden administration, is now back on. That will likely be completed within a few years. And it's anticipated that those Virginia class submarines, probably most or all of them, will be re again revert to being able to carry nuclear armed sea launched cruise missiles. And disturbingly, as you alluded to in Senate estimates in December, both senior foreign affairs and defence officials confirmed that essentially is aware of, acknowledges that the Virginia-class US submarines may again become nuclear capable and armed, but confirmed that Australia has no problem essentially with accepting the neither confirm nor deny policy and would accept if nuclear capable or armed platforms enter Australia. So, a really frightening escalation of Australia's enmeshment in all things nuclear that really puts us in the front line of any US war over Taiwan or with China over anything else. And this from a government that ostensibly, has a national policy platform commitment to join the Nuclear Weapons Prohibition Treaty. It really escalates the profound urgency for them to deliver on that commitment, which provides the best framework to walk Australia back from these really disturbing developments of increasingly playing a role, not just in terms of intelligence and communications, but actual operational deployments of US nuclear forces and potentially being a launch pad for nuclear weapons. Really disturbing developments that need to be countered really urgently.
Well, just to wrap up, I think as we've covered in our conversation, this focus on START shows really a big failure in an approach that's based on deterrence and arms control, and how precarious that is as an instrument for avoiding a nuclear catastrophe, which makes the UN Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons more important than ever. What do you think it will take to get Australia to sign on?
Look, this should be the time, Michaela. I really think, this is now long-standing Labor policy. It was adopted in 2018. It's been reaffirmed at the two national conferences subsequently in Sydney and Brisbane. Many other aspects of the policy didn't survive. The policy is now much slimmer than it was in 2018, but it's still there and it was being strongly supported at each of those conferences. When it was adopted in Adelaide in 2018, it was moved by the current Prime Minister, Mr. Albanese, and seconded by the current Deputy PM and Defence Minister, Richard Marles. So this is long-standing Labor policy. If the government is all about doing what they said they'd do and delivering on commitments, then now's the time to do this. Early in a second term with a substantial majority and the best time to sign international treaties is early in a term before you get anywhere close to the pre-election mode and the caretaker period. And so this is the year. And in the world, there's so much that's going in a really disturbing direction. The risks of nuclear dangers are going up on multiple fronts. The doomsday clock this year has again moved further forward than it has ever been before. I mean, we don't have the luxury of complacency or of time here. And Australia's stepping up to take a bold initiative and fulfill an existing promise is really overdue. We have strong support in the parliament, almost half the total parliament, but about three quarters of the Federal Labor Parliamentary Caucus has signed the ICAN parliamentary pledge publicly, indicating their support for Australia joining the treaty. Most of the crossbench support that. Consistently, we show in polls, we've now done about half a dozen, consistently between 70 or 80 and 80% of Australians want Australia to join this treaty, and the number who oppose that is very small, 5-6%. It's very consistent. And there's lots that we've been doing in terms of the AUKUS submarine plans, in terms of these B-52 deployments, deepening our enmeshment with the US militarily and including its nuclear forces, losing our capacity for independent action, becoming an increasing priority target for adversaries of the United States. There's a really urgent need for the government to fulfill long promise that they made, a global situation that really demands nations step up clearly on the side of disarmament. AUKUS really increases the urgency of the government putting firm guardrails around any such plan so that it's clear that they will not be the thin end of the wedge for nuclear weapons in Australia, either under this government or any future governments. So I think where ICAN's call is really now's the time to join this treaty, and our firm expectation is that this really needs to happen at or by the National Conference, the Labor National Conference in Adelaide at the end of July this year. That's really our firm expectation, and I think we're visiting state capitals, talking to parliamentarians all over the country, talking to unions, talking to people involved in the Labor Party policy development process, but talking more widely with our partners, really trying to mobilise civil society pressure and expectation that now's the time that we want the government to step up on our behalf and join this historic treaty, which is really the only bright spot in the landscape, the darkening nuclear landscape that we're in, and really important, ever more important, to get Australia on the right side of history here, part of the solution and not just a worsening part of the problem.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for joining us on the show, being so generous with your time, and thank you for all your work across many decades on this vital issue.
Thanks very much, Michaela.
That brings us to the end of today's Radioactive Show. I've been speaking with Dr. Tilman Ruff, an amazing public health physician and longtime campaigner for nuclear disarmament. If you want to join in with the push to get Australia to sign on to the United Nations Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, the best place to go is the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons website, and that is icanw.org.au. And they're looking for all the support they can get pushing for the signing of the treaty in the lead up to the Australian Labor Party National Conference that will be held at the Adelaide Convention Centre from July 23rd to 25th. Thanks so much for listening today. And thanks so much to the Nuclear Free Collective at Friends of the Earth Melbourne for the ongoing financial support for the show. Thanks also to the Community Radio Network for getting this program out to community radio stations across the continent every week. And tune in again next week for more news and views on nuclear, peace and energy issues.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.